News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ. You know that each week we visit with World War II veterans. The idea is to honor them for their service, for their sacrifice, to preserve their stories for posterity, and along the way learn a thing or two about what it means to truly love our country. Most of the time, the folks you hear from on this show are people that you've never heard of before. Every once in a while, we make an exception. We've had some famous athletes, some Hall of Famers on this show, and today we have a famous sportscaster whose World War II background is something he hasn't gotten into too much over the years. We're going to try to do that today. And instead of introducing him myself, I think I'll let him do the honors as we go back in time just a few years to a big game at Candlestick Park. Let's listen.
Back to throw. In trouble. He's going to be sacked. No, gets away. He runs, gets away again, goes to the 40, gets away again to the 35. Cuts back at the 30, to the 20, the 15, the 10. He dives. Touchdown, 49ers. Young is exhausted. He stumbled as he got to the 2. He could barely move. He dived into the end zone. And the 49ers have taken the lead with 158, a 49-yard touchdown run by Steve Young.
I remember it like it was yesterday. I was riding my bike to an evening church service in my hometown of Los Banos and almost ran into oncoming traffic because of that incredible call and that incredible moment. Lon Simmons, the guy behind that call. Lon, do you get tired of hearing people play back all your calls from all the years of sports announcing?
No, not really. I don't hear them all when they get played back. But what we used to do when I was first with the Giants and the 49ers, all we used to record, tape everything, and then if a player made a great play, we would single that out, put it together, and give it to them as a tape that they kept. And a lot of the ball players from the past came back to me and say, "Oh yeah, I've still got that tape, and I listen to it every once in a while. When I'm feeling low, I listen to it, and I feel good about what I did then." But it's a good thing to for the players, especially to remember or look back and see how what they did at that time was recognized over the air. But with me and Steve Young, it turned out, I told Steve later when I talked to him, I said, you know, we both ran out of gas at about the same time.
But you both put points on the board, and I think that call, as someone who tries to do what you did for so many years for a living, I think what you really did was you captured the sheer incredulity of that call. No one saw that play coming, and it really was remarkable that he was able to do what he did. And I think you could hear that in your voice, that you were as surprised as anyone else.
Well, I was, because it looked definitely like he was going to be sacked. He was surrounded, and he got out. The only thing that I missed, and I regretted that I missed, was a comeback block by Randy Cross in the middle of that run that helped save the day, too, because he certainly should have been credited as, at least partially as much as Steve was.
Well, you just gave him the credit here, so I think that'll be good enough for his ego as a UCLA guy. Lon Simmons is our guest. You know him as a famous sports announcer, a Hall of Fame baseball broadcaster, all those years as he told it goodbye for the San Francisco Giants. You might know that he got his start, or one of his starts, in radio here in Fresno as the voice of the Fresno State Bulldogs, who are in Hawaii tonight to take on the Rainbow Warriors. Lon now lives in Maui for most of the year. But you don't miss out on a chance to go see your Giants every year, do you?
Well, no, I still actually am connected with the Giants, and I usually take about 6 trips back a year. In fact, I'll be going to spring training for a week again this year. I didn't go last year. It's getting tougher and tougher to travel, and especially when a round trip means that I'm flying 5,000 miles and 10 hours in the air, and not to count all the time that it takes getting to the airport and from the airport.
Well, I don't blame you, and I'm sure you've long lost track of all the air miles that you have in your long career, but I want to talk about some of those sea miles, the nautical miles that you traveled in the U.S. Coast Guard. Let's go back if we can. I thought you were a Southern California guy, but I saw something on the internet that said you were from Elko, Nevada. Is that true?
This is what upsets me about the internet or Facebook or any of those things. They get somebody just posts something on there, and it's not true. In fact, I think somebody told me I don't have I don't have anything like equipment like that within 1,000 yards of my place where I live over here. But
smart man.
Anyway, somebody told me that they saw that, and that it said that I was born in Elko, Nevada. Well, that's not true at all. And then it said also, and there's something about I announced in Fresno for the Fresno Hot Flashes or something like that.
That would be a good name.
So it's weird. I mean, and they were on two separate things. They had the same information. So somebody copied it from somebody else. But see, that's the problem with those things that are posted on there, is they don't always tell the truth. I was born in Vancouver, Washington, moved to Southern California when I was a year old. I moved simply because my parents moved and I had to go with them. And so I spent all of my school years and growing up years until I went into the service in Southern California.
That's what I thought. I'd already heard about, always heard about you and Bill Thompson and Southern California. So I'm glad you cleared that up for us. Well, let's talk about then December 7th, 1941. I know you didn't have any choice when you were 1 year old whether or not to move with your parents, as you so subtly put it there. But did you end up having a choice after Japan attacked America on whether or not you'd end up in the service?
Well, see, at that time they had developed a draft.
Yes.
I don't think I had signed up by that time. I don't think I was. It was necessary for me to sign up because at that time, 1941, I was just 17 years old. And I remember December 7th because, Bill Thompson and I and some of my other pals had gone to the beach on that day. And we came back, and there were newspapers out with the headlines about the Pearl Harbor attack. And so that was the first time that I was aware of that. Well, naturally, from that point on, things changed a great deal, but I wasn't able to get into the service until the end of 1942.
Mm-hmm. So you enlisted in the Coast Guard?
Yes. What I did is a group of us, well, Bill Thompson and another friend of ours, Dick Thornhill, we decided we had all gone in to try to sign up. In fact, I'd gone in to sign up with the Air Force. And I had something happened that I didn't get a chance to sign up. But anyway, we went to Glendale College because it was the spring, and we thought, well, let's go to Glendale and play baseball. Mm-hmm. So the three of us went, and there were about five or six other guys, and it turned out to be that we had about 12 that made up a team at Glendale College. And we played. We won the Southern California Championship there and lost only one game against an opponent, a junior college, and they called him then, a junior college opponent. And that one game, I lost. We had two pitchers, me and a fellow by the name of Jim Smith, and I lost the game. The second game, we played round robin with the Southern California junior colleges, and I pitched against the Los Angeles team in the second game. We beat them in the first game earlier in the year, and then in the second game I lost in 13 innings. Bill and Dick and I worked for the Bank of America, and we worked at the clearinghouse, and what would happen is we had to go in at night and work. So we'd go to school in the morning and daytime, practice baseball or play baseball games in the afternoon, and then go in and go to work. Well, the night before we played L.A. City College in this game that I lost, we worked all night long. We didn't get off work till 6 in the morning. And so we came back to Bill's house and then went over to play the game, and naturally it had to go 13 innings, and in the 13th inning, they scored a couple of runs against me, and we lost 3-1. That was that situation, and we then tried to sign up again, and they were having so much trouble that even after we were signed up, they couldn't call us because they were having so much difficulty processing all the people that were going into the service.
Right.
And we were sort of on the tail end, but we went and worked for the shipyards, and played baseball for the shipyard team and worked in the shipyards and worked graveyard, naturally. And So that was, and then eventually got into the service.
Well, I'm sure your dream, as you're pitching 13-inning ball games and pitching for a team that only lost that one game, you had aspirations of playing baseball beyond that. And I'm curious, just from a baseball standpoint, as I think back on that time, 70 years ago, really, West Coast baseball at the major league level didn't exist. So
no, it was Pacific Coast League golf. But what happened is at the end of the year at Glendale, mm-hmm. Rod Dedeaux, the USC coach, see, I grew up an avid USC fan. From the time I was about 4 years old, I remember listening to their game. And I still am an avid fan. So anyway, at the end of our baseball season, Rod Dedeaux offered Ken McBride, our catcher, and me a scholarship to USC.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about it's something that lights up your eyes. But already we, Bill and Dick and I had decided to go in the service. So I didn't take it, but Ken McBride did.
Mm-hmm.
So go flash ahead to 1944 when I was on the LST, and we had received mail. We picked up mail various places. I can't even remember how we got it, but we got this mail, and in it was a Life magazine. And the Life magazine said the life of a V-12 or whatever they called them,
yeah,
student. And it showed Ken McBride, and he was sitting at a table, and there were about 10 USC co-eds lined up around him. And I said, my God, how did I make this bad a mistake?
You know?
But that was funny that he was there. But going, you know, still farther ahead, when I was doing Fresno State sports, we came to play University of Hawaii, and I met Ken at the airport, and he was still in the Marines, because after you finished your college, you had to go into the service for, I think, a limited time, maybe 4 years, I don't know.
Right.
But anyway, he was still in the Marines. He was a captain of the Marines, and I said, well, this is the only time I'm not jealous of you.
Well, I don't blame you back in the time to open up a magazine and see that and wonder what could have been. What was the Coast Guard like for you? And you went in with a couple of buddies, but were you able to stick with those buddies throughout your time in the Coast Guard?
No. We all signed up together, and we were all sent in different directions. And at that time, although there was the famous incident, I think, of two brothers being killed on the same ship that was sunk,
yeah,
the military tried to keep good friends and relatives separated. They didn't want you to be in situations, if they were dire situations, where either that many people from a family would be killed or injured in the same action, or they didn't want that to affect how you reacted in those situations. So we were separated, and the funny part was how we joined the Coast Guard was unbelievable. I don't know how we did it, because we were all thinking about first getting in the Naval Air Force, and that didn't work out. And then we were, I don't know what we were thinking. Then we saw this sign that said, not Uncle Sam wants you, but the Coast Guard wants you. And it showed this PT boat and everything. So we thought, well, heck, let's try that. So we went down there, and they were more than happy to take us in. But we still had to wait after we signed up before we were called into service.
Mm-hmm.
And it was several months, and so we continued working at the shipyards during that time.
Was there any part of that where you thought, you know, I really want to play baseball, and going into the service is going to interrupt my baseball career?
No, I didn't think about that then. I didn't give it one thought. I knew that I was going into the service. I felt I wanted to go into the service. I felt that's where I should be. And I don't know why I felt that the Coast Guard was the place I was supposed to be, but it turned out that. And naturally, I had to take a lot of flack from people from the Navy and the Marines because of the shield on the arm. That, what's that for? And they would say, well, that's because they're shallow water sailors. And I said, well, some of the shallow water I got into was pretty deep. But anyway, the thing is that I never gave it another thought about baseball. And in the service, I was in for of, three and a half years or more in that service. I never played any baseball. I played catch a couple of times, and on the LST, when we'd dump off the large landing craft that we had on the front, the deck would be fairly clear. So I had a buddy there, and we had baseballs and basketballs, and what we didn't have, we couldn't play basketball. We had baseballs and a big weighted,
like a medicine ball or something.
Medicine
huh?
ball, yeah. Okay, well, we had those on there. So I used to play catch with him, but when the ship, I'd be throwing to him, but when the ship would go down, the ball would go right over his head out in the ocean. And so one day I was up on wheel watch, and the officer of the deck said to me, he wasn't a great baseball fan, but he says, the guys had the medicine ball on the deck. And he said, well, he says, at least, he says, you've lost all the baseballs and whatever else we had. I guess we had a football, too, and we lost that. He says, but that's one thing we won't lose. And as he said that, the guy threw the medicine ball at another guy, and the ship took a roll, and it hit the deck and rolled into the water. So that was the end of his story right there.
What's left of that medicine ball is at the bottom of the ocean somewhere. We need to take our first commercial break, but when we come back, more with Lon Simmons, 88 years old. You know him as the legendary voice of the Giants, A's, and 49ers. But when we come back, we'll explore more about his service in the U.S. Coast Guard in World War II. First, a few words about a business that was here 55 years ago when Lon was announcing Bulldog Sports here on KMJ.
It's as simple as ABC, friends, no tea.
I can remember hearing that jingle on the radio for years, but I didn't really understand what it meant until redoing my shower a couple years ago. This is Paul Leffler, proud to welcome Fresno Distributing as a sponsor of Hometown Heroes here on KMJ. The knucklehead who tiled my shower, that would be yours truly, left a decent-sized hole around the shower arm. I needed an oversized flange to cover it, and I went all over town. None of the chain stores had what I needed. Finally, a merciful soul asked me, have you tried Fresno D? Fresno D, as in duh, why didn't I think of that in the first place? So I quickly took the 41 to the McKinley exit, walked into Fresno Distributing, and bumped smack dab into the owner, Steve Cloud. He said he was sure they had exactly what I needed, and of course, he was right. Now I make Fresno D my first stop, whether I'm looking for one of those obscure plumbing parts or a top-of-the-line appliance, like the new Electrolux energy-efficient washer and dryer set my wife picked out. They have all the other top brands, too. Don't make the mistake I did. If you want your first stop to be your last stop, make a beeline for Fresno D. And while you're there, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. It is a thrill for me every week to meet the veterans we have on this show. What a blessing that's been over the years. I love my job, which tonight has me in Hawaii for Fresno State basketball against the Rainbow Warriors. One thing that makes me feel so privileged to serve as the voice of the Bulldogs on the radio is the great respect I have for the men in whose footsteps I follow. For so many years, Bill Woodward, before that, the late, great Gus Zernial, who was in the Navy in World War II and once appeared on this program to talk about it. And if you tuned into KMJ to hear a Bulldog game in the mid-1950s, you heard the one and only Lon Simmons giving you the scoop. Just a few years later, he was at the microphone for this.
Two down, bases empty, Giants 6, Dodgers 4, bottom of the ninth. Here's Wines, here's the pitch. A line drive to center. This could be it. Mays waiting. He's got it. It goes for the pennant. The
Giants have won it. As Mays pierces mouth by the Giants, they've won it 6-4 on a dramatic four-run rally in the ninth. The Giants are going crazy.
That'll be 50 years ago this fall, the Giants winning the National League in 1962 before falling to the Yankees in Bobby Richardson's well-placed glove in the World Series. I want to go further back than that, though, as we continue exploring Lon Simmons' service in the Coast Guard during World War II. What was the most jarring aspect of being in the Coast Guard for you? Was it an adjustment? I mean, you sound like a hardworking guy if you're going to school and playing baseball and working at the bank all night, but did the Coast Guard whip you into even better shape?
They were pretty good. You had to go through, in fact, going through our boot camp up in Alameda in the Bay Area, the first shock I had was getting on the train in Los Angeles, leaving home for the first time, and going, and I think it took us something like 16 hours to get to Alameda.
Mm-hmm.
And now we get off the train, and it's the middle of the night. We get off the train, and this boat's there, and he says, "All right, you guys, line up." And now we go in and get in the barracks, and they issue us some equipment and stuff. And I thought, "Oh my God, what have I done? Where's my bed?" And so that was sort of an introduction. But then you go through boot camp, and it was pretty strenuous. Not as strenuous, I don't imagine, as the Army or the Marines, but it was certainly a strenuous camp. And we had incidents there where you talk about being hazed and stuff, that occurred, that the bosuns were tough guys and they made you do things that ordinarily you wouldn't want to do or probably shouldn't do.
You wouldn't be the first guy I'd pick on, though.
Well, I didn't know. Are you going to fight back?
I guess not, but you had to be one of the bigger guys.
I spent a great deal of my time in the service getting out of things. When I went on a ship, I worked myself to death the first few weeks. I volunteered for everything. I did everything. And so I became a guy that they thought, well, here's somebody that really does everything. Then later on, they were appointing guys to do things, and I wouldn't be around, and I wouldn't be called because they weren't worried about me. They knew I was going to be working anyway. And so the guys used to get on me about that, and I said, well, it's just how you act. You tried to get out of everything right away. I did everything right away and waited to get out of it until they thought I was a really good sailor.
I think there are some life lessons there in that story.
I think one of the things that I think, looking back on my career in the service, that we won the war despite me.
Well, you know, that's, I think, one of the things that has endeared you to so many is you've always been so self-deprecating, and you come up with some great lines that we've heard over the years, and there's another one of them. But I want to hear about some of that action. If you spend 3.5 years in the Coast Guard, I'm sure not every day was the same. Were there ever days and places that you thought, you know what, I wonder what Ken McWright's doing right now, and am I ever going to get back into a situation like that?
You know, honestly, as I look back, probably it seems better than I felt at the time. But we never – one of the things I had in my mind, you talk about baseball, I used to look at the other guys on the ship and feel sorry for them because I knew what I was going to do when I got back.
Mm.
I was going to play professional baseball. That was my idea. I always felt I was going to be a major league pitcher. As it turned out, the only reason I didn't become a major league pitcher was because of the hitters. But I always felt that's what I was going to do. So I had that idea, and we had, you know, we doing all these things that we did, that we had to do, that was GI or whatever, we did, but we had fun in between. We had times when we didn't look at being in the service as a bad thing. We looked at it as being in the service, as that's where we were supposed to be. I mean, our country was at war. Where were we supposed to be?
Mm-hmm.
And I know one time we came back on Liberty, when I came back, my friend Steve Crippen and I came back together on leave. It was the first leave we'd had. We came back to the mainland, and we came to my folks' house and stayed at my folks' house. And I had some suits there, and they fitted us both. And so, stupid, we went and we put on our my suits, and we went out nightclubbing, and now we caught all sorts of mess. And now we couldn't say anything, because if we said, oh, we're in the service, well, we just put on civilian clothes, then we could have been court-martialed for not having our uniform on. Mm-hmm. And the second thing, we just had to take all the heat. Ah, you 4F son of a guns and all that sort of stuff. So that was the last time we tried to do that. that was an experiment that didn't work out.
I guess so. You talk about a rock and a hard place. You were in a bad spot either way on that. So as far as the ship was concerned, what kind of duties did you have to perform on the ship? Where were some of the places that you went, and how much of the world did you get to see?
The first ship that we went on, and it turned out my buddy who lasted with me every place we went on a Coast Guard cutter. Mm-hmm. Here we came to another camp that was almost like a boot camp here in Oahu. Mm-hmm. And then that was sort of a base where they were shipped out to where we're doing. Well, he and I went on a cutter, and that was on submarine patrol. So we were on that and took sub patrol off of the and around the islands. And so we traveled to most all the islands in Hawaii, and then we would either come into Pearl Harbor to dock or to Honolulu to dock. Mm-hmm. So our job there was to basically just keep the ship running and do our chores and stand watch and stand wheel watch and such as that and do normal ship duties. But there were occasions like now we had to, Navy used to do bombing on Kohalavi here and they needed equipment to build structures that they were going to bomb.
Right.
So on the cutter, we had a pulling boat, single bank that we used, and so we went over. We had to go over to Kohalavi, and we had all this equipment that we were carrying over there, and we had to take it ashore on our pulling boat. So it was just like surfing. We had to go through the surf to get to the sand. And the one time take us into the sand, and we'd get off, pull the boat up on there, and take the equipment off, and then we would go back, and we'd have to run out through the breakers and all running, pushing the boat, and get out there, and then jump in the boat and just grab your paddle and start paddling so we could get through the break like you're trying to get out if you're going out to ride a surfboard in. But the one day coming in, we breached. The boat flipped completely over and threw us all out of the boat, and our oarlocks were still in the gunwale, and the boat came down and hit me on the gunwale hit me on the head, and fortunately I was in deep enough water that it was a pretty heavy boat, and it hit me and knocked me down deeper into the water, but it didn't. Knock me out, or it didn't kill me, or it didn't crush me. I just went down and then came back up. But fortunately, those oarlocks were still in there. If one of those had hit me in the head, it certainly would have done some damage. And then one of the members of the crew wasn't thrown out, but he was up in the bow of the boat, and the boat was still tipped over, and he just came up on the beach plowing sand with his hands. And so that was quite an experience, but it was a fun job running out through the waves, pretending we were surfers, getting out there. So it was an interesting incident. We had many of those where they were interesting things that we did. And then one time we had a skipper who was sort of a character, and we had a, what was it called? The only armament we had on the boat was can't remember what it was, but it was a small cannon. Uh-huh. And so now we're out on patrol, and we flash identification numbers at night to the ship that we see, and it doesn't return the call. So our skipper figures, well, that's an enemy craft out there, so he sends us all to general quarters. We take the cover off the gun, and we're getting ready to fire at the ship. And fortunately, they returned the call finally, and it was a U.S. destroyer.
Ooh.
And if we'd have fired one little round, we would have been blown completely out of the water. But it was funny because he was really gung ho. He thought that was a Japanese ship, and we were gonna blow it away.
You know, and these are the stories that I get a kick out of, and I think back. Every guy that I've had on this show, every World War II veteran, can point to a moment where if things go a little differently, he's not here talking to me. And so many of our great sports figures had the same kind of stories. John Wooden was destined to be on the USS Franklin and would have been kamikaze'd if he didn't have a knee injury right before he was supposed to go over. And for you, I guess, if you got hit on the head a little harder by that ship, or if that other one, if the destroyer hadn't finally returned that communication, then you wouldn't have had the chance to call all those great players.
But the thing is that then when we went on the LST, we were all tied up in Honolulu, Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
28 LSTs were tied up, all loaded with troops and ammunition and big landing boats on our deck. And there was some welding going on one of the ships, and it caused an explosion.
Mm.
Now everything started blowing up. Ships started catching on fire. We had to chop lines to get out, and some of the troops that were on the ships panicked and were diving over the side into the water instead of staying on the ship.
Like that's going to be safer, huh?
And they're now in the water where these ships are all coming out trying to get out of that place where we were to get to a safe area, and they were hit by the ships, and some of the ships were badly damaged. And nothing was ever mentioned about it,
right?
But because of the fact that we were getting ready to go to Saipan, which we did,
mm-hmm.
they didn't want any mention of this happening because they didn't want any news to get the Japanese. I'm sure the Japanese knew about it as soon as it happened, but that was a thing that was never reported happened. But
well,
it was an amazing thing with ships blowing up and ammunition going off and everything. And our captain was blown right off the deck, onto the deck off of the wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a weird, wild thing. But we got it back together and eventually got on our way and went to Saipan.
And I guess you had to kind of stand by and watch helplessly through all of that, huh?
Well, there was not much you could do except try to get the ship untied from the other. We were all tied together,
right?
And chop the lines and get out, and nothing we could do except the engineers and stuff had to start the engines and get those going, and we were just going to get out of there. I was running, my buddy and I. We had two personnel landing barges on the LST, and he and I ran those. And that was our means of transportation when we were in the harbor, and it was our means of taking the troops ashore when we were in a place where they had to land.
So how many landings did you participate in
just
that
one? Just
at Saipan? And for people in the big picture of things, the taking of Saipan and then Tinian really kind of set the stage for the way the end of the war.
Yeah, well, see, when we were at Saipan, we were on the beach to get some of the troops went out through our open doors. We had the LSTs had doors that folded over in the front. They made the bow, but behind that there was an opening because a platform had to come down for any things on wheels to go out on, or for to make it easier for the soldiers or Marines to get out on. Well, in behind that there was a space that was filled with, well, because the water would get in there, but it would be filled up behind the ramp and between these doors. So that's where we would go swimming in there when we were on shore or offshore when the water would fill up in there. But the thing is when we were on the beach, the Japanese were leaving Saipan to get over to Tinian, and that's where they had the Royal troops, the supposedly the top troops in Japan, were on Tinian, and the Japanese on Saipan were coming out at night and rubber boats and everything else that they had to get across the Tinian, and they were going behind us, all of which were on the beach. And then sometimes as they'd go by, they'd have machine guns or something, they'd shoot up the ship, so we had to be on watch all the time. And then Tinian, they were firing big guns at us, but they couldn't quite reach us. They were just falling short of us, so we were never hit by any of them.
But obviously they got your attention. We're overdue for another quick time out here. Hall of Fame sports announcer Lon Simmons is our guest today. He never would have come up with that famous tell it goodbye home run call if he didn't make it through 3.5 years in the Coast Guard in World War II. More with Lon when Hometown Heroes continues right after another thought about one of our proud sponsors of Hometown Heroes on KMJ, Fresno Distributing. What do you think of when I say Fresno D? Probably that catchy little jingle, right?
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Paul Leffler here to tell you what it means to me. It means Fresno Distributing's selection of top-of-the-line appliances at wholesale prices for you, me, and everybody means you don't have to go anywhere else. Since I started hosting Bulldog Coaches shows in Fresno D's showroom a few years back, I've gotten to know the owner, Steve Cloud, quite well. I know that some of his favorites are King Tut, Coca-Cola with real sugar in it, and of course the Bulldogs. I know not to challenge him in gin rummy because he's a former world champion, no joke. But the other thing I know, and here's why my wife and I picked out our new Electrolux washer and dryer there, I know the Cloud family has been carrying the best appliances you can find anywhere since 1946. Bosch, Frigidaire, Maytag, Jennair, KitchenAid, Wolf, you name it. They have it. Don't just take my word for it. Go see for yourself at Fresno Distributing on McKinley between Blackstone and 41. Plumbing, lighting, electrical, kitchen, bath, whatever you need, Fresno D has it. And you won't find friendlier or more knowledgeable service anywhere. A locally owned business with great prices, great selection, and great service. Why go anywhere else? Still as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Lon Simmons. He's 88 years old now, but still has that silky smooth voice that landed him in the broadcaster's wing of the Baseball Hall of Fame, as well as the Fresno Athletic Hall of Fame, which he entered with his lifelong friend Bill Thompson 10 years ago. When we left off, we were talking about nearly 70 years ago, the Battle of Saipan in June of 1944. Serving in the U.S. Coast Guard, Lon landed troops on the island, as well as taking some of the wounded and incapacitated back to their ships. You talked about being just out of reach of those Japanese guns. What was it like, though, even though they couldn't hit you? Yeah. You're there, big guns, and you're unloading some of the biggest guns, these big tanks off an LST. These guns are firing all the time. The planes are going overhead bombing. You're seeing...
Well, see, the funny part of it is that we were... Where we were there, we had air alerts, but we never had a direct bombing attack on the ships for some reason. I don't know. And these guys weren't able to reach us, so we weren't too concerned about that. We were a little concerned about the ones going behind us when they went over to Tinian shooting up the ships, but ours never got shot up. So it wasn't... And then when we were on duty, my buddy and I were on the our landing barges that we took. We went around to all the other ships. We would go in and pick people up off the beach and take them to the ships that they'd come in on, either for medical attention or if they were being relieved there. So we were traveling around doing that and taking supplies off some of the ships and everything. So that was our tour of duty there when the ship was on the beach.
Was it difficult emotionally to see these wounded soldiers that you're taking back to ships?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I picked up one fellow one day who was, he had been on the opening day of invasion. This was about 5 or 6 days later, and he still thought it was, he wasn't wounded, but he was just completely shocked. He still thought it was D-Day on the island. He still thought it was the first day that he came on.
Wow.
And there were others. See, what happened there at Saipan, too, is they would dig foxholes, and the troops would go in the foxholes at night, but many of the Japanese soldiers could speak English, and they would, at night, would sneak over and come over to one of these foxholes and say something about, hey, buddy, what you, and jump into the foxhole with the guy, and the guy would think it was an American soldier, and they'd kill the guys in the foxhole.
Right.
And so that was a treacherous thing. So they really had a tough job. I never considered having a tough job being on that ship when we were on the beach, because we said goodbye to the guys, and they had to go out there and take the majority of the problems. The ship that I was off, and my buddy and I were really upset about it, because we took, when we came back, it was an old LST, and we thought, well, we'll take our 30 days leave, and then we'll come back and get on a new LST, and it'll go to another place. Well, they took our old LST and went to the Philippines, and that's where we'd wanted to go.
Uh-huh.
And so they got to go to the Philippines, and we did. So that was upsetting. Talk about, we were in, and we wanted to get in all the action we could, because we felt that was the only way that we were really helping anything.
Do you remember the number of your LST?
I think it was the 205 or something. I can't remember exactly, but there was a picture taken of us. See, you weren't allowed in your letters to the family to say where you were or what you were doing. The 205 or 305, I don't remember. Something that's pretty close. But there was a picture taken of the LSTs at Saipan, and it was put in the newspaper. And my mother picked up the newspaper, and there was my LST with the number on it there, so she knew where I was.
How about that? You didn't even have to write it.
I didn't even have to. I couldn't write it, but she found out where I was. I don't know if it made her any happier or not, but she knew where I was.
You know, I think throughout our conversation here, I hear an undertone that you feel fortunate to have been where you were and realize that there are a lot of places you could have been that would have been a lot worse. But
well, I'm not saying I'm fortunate. I'm saying I'm probably that I didn't suffer through the war like a lot of guys who were in did. I mean, to be in thinking of major battles or where you're hitting the beach and your percentage of getting hit is probably about 99.8. is, I mean, unbelievable. I don't know. I always felt of myself as being able to face things, but I don't know how I would have reacted in that.
Sure.
I was able to react to some incidents, but nothing that was anything compared to how those fellows faced that had to go on the beach.
What were the moments that maybe scared you or took you to the place where you thought, you know what, I don't know if I'm going to get through this. I don't know if I'm waking up tomorrow, or that in retrospect you said, wow, I was really fortunate to get through that.
I don't recall any. You know, you don't think about those things. I mean, if you think about them, if you think you're going to survive whatever happens. I never felt that. I remember when we were going to Saipan and we had on their truck was one of the big bases of the Japanese, and this entire flight of Japanese bombers came over us. And here we had this hole, and the biggest guns we had were destroyers that were escorting us. They could have dropped bombs without impunity because we couldn't have reached them.
Mm-hmm.
And they just flew right over us and didn't do anything. And they had to be able to see us. So, I don't know, things just sort of worked out for me not to get killed, I guess.
We're all thankful for that, for a lot of reasons.
I don't know how thankful we have to be. There are a lot of people that couldn't give thanks because they were killed
yes.
doing what they were what they had to do and what they were supposed to do, and I never felt that my duty was a chore. I felt it was an obligation, and an obligation that I accepted, and that I certainly didn't resent, because we were attacked. We were protecting. One of the things that entered in the opposite direction, though, if I can go back to when I was in Glendale College, Shigo Kata was our third baseman, a Japanese kid, probably our best player.
Uh-huh.
Now, before they sent the Japanese out of Southern California to other places in the United States to these internment camps, they supposedly weren't supposed to go more than 30 miles away from their house or anything. Well, Shig was playing on the ball club, and we had to go out of town to play games. So, stupid kids, you know, we thought, oh, well, get him in the car. And we used to drive our cars. We didn't have a team bus or anything. We took our cars. And so in our car, we'd have Shig get in the back seat and lie down on the seat so nobody could see him and see that we were transporting him more than 30 miles. I mean, as stupid as that sounds, that's what we did. So he had to lie down all the way to their game and all the way back from our game.
Wow.
And then, but unfortunately, before the season was over, he was taken away, and I never found out what happened to him or anything else. It was an unfortunate affair that in those days, in Southern California, in the school that I went to, there were more Japanese students than there were black students in
right.
the schools.
Well, and here in the Central Valley, too, yeah.
A lot of my friends were Japanese kids, and especially Shig, who was one of the stars of our team, he was our close friend, and we, you know, it was a tough thing to lose him and just have him disappear from sight.
Different times for sure. I can't imagine how hard that must have been, and now in retrospect, it's even harder to fathom how that was justified. But that was the world you were living.
Well, it always happened. It happened in World War One. It happened in World War Two. It happened in Iraq. It always happens that you feel that you are, and it happened here on Hawaii, you feel that you're being attacked by Germans or Japanese or whoever, and that suddenly they're all your enemies. Well, they weren't all our enemies, but the people were concerned about people being spies or whatever, so the government decided they had to take this step to put them all there. And it was, at the time, it seemed right to them. As it was reviewed, I don't think it even seemed right to them, but it sure seemed strange to us.
I can only imagine. We're out of time on the show today. We'll pick up this conversation with Hall of Fame broadcaster Lon Simmons next Saturday, another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.